Relationships are complicated and they are messy. And I think one of the ways we react against that is we try to look for simple, clear, black and white rules for how we should be in relationship with others. I think that's why last week when we looked at solitude, you saw these early Christians asking Paul, well, should we just give us a rule, a black and white truth? Is it better to be single, better to be married? Can you just give us something clear to cling to? And it's also why Paul had to spend an entire chapter bringing nuance to that question, because the real answer is that truth is only true in context. And without context, truth actually becomes untrue. And that's why Paul had to spend all this time saying, it's not about single or married, it's about these deeper things, and he had to talk about all these different situations and scenarios, because the context changes what the truth is. There's not a black and white simple rule that we can just follow when it comes to relationships. And that's especially true as we talk today about the second state of relationship, pursuit. After you get solitude right, we move to pursuit. And we are all, as human beings, constantly in this pursuing phase of relationship. Right, we're doing this all the time. You're thinking about all the people around you that maybe you'd be more interested in being closer with, and you make advances, right? And it's everything as little as a new person at work, and you invite them to join you at the lunch table, right? That's a pursuit moment. Or it's up to even, there's someone that you admire, you respect, maybe in your field or in the business world, and you ask them out for lunch or coffee because you just want to learn from them. That's pursuit. And most obviously, and especially on Valentine's Day weekend, when there's someone that you think is so interesting and appealing and you actually want to pursue them romantically. But we're all doing this all the time. You've got these people that you don't know well, and you are interested and curious about them. You want to know them better in the hopes that maybe there's a long-term relationship. Maybe there's a deeper connection that's waiting for you both where you can grow and learn and bless each other. And we want a nice, clear, simple rule to govern and guide how we pursue relationships in a healthy way that blesses everyone involved. And for a long time, Christian culture, for the last 25, 30 years or so, Christian culture has been very content to give you and me one very simple black and white answer for the way that good Christians pursue relationships with other people, a way that looks different from the world. And most especially when we talk about what a dating culture should look like for Christians, and the simple black and white answer that has been given for the last three decades is something called purity culture. It's been embodied in books like I Kiss Dating Goodbye by Joshua Harris, who says that the right Christian way to date is to not have sex before marriage, and that's the thing that matters. And if you just get that right, everything else will work. Or it's the True Love Waits movement that was about the same time that would gather just teens from all over the country together and say, true love waits, and that's the thing. That's the one thing that matters. Do that. Or it even culminated in this idea of making a promise and having purity rings, which were modeled by none other than, anyone recognize those guys? Yeah, Jonas Brothers. Jonas Brothers were into the purity ring movement. And people liked that, they gravitated to that, because it was in the messiness and the complicatedness of relationships, of dating, it was a nice, clear, simple answer. The problem is, truth out of context becomes untrue. Not only that, it becomes toxic. And we now also have 30 years of examples of what happens when you take one biblical truth and you elevate it and expand it and make it the only thing that matters out of the context of the larger biblical narrative. See, what happened was the purity culture said that the thing that matters most about you, the thing that identifies you, is your sexuality. And that's it. That's the most important thing. And that your spiritual practice, your holiness, your relationship with God is defined by your sexual practice. And then that leads to shaming for anyone who falls short of that ideal. I mean, when you've got such a clear, simple guideline, that's it. If you either keep it or you mess it up. And if you mess it up, well, you blew it. And now your marriage is going to be worse. Now God is going to like you less. See, the other problem with purity culture is it leads to something called the prosperity gospel, which is this idea that if we just connect all the dots right, if we live and keep all the rules, then God will bless us. It's a very transactional way of thinking. And it's also not true. It's not anything that the Bible ever promised. There are right ways to live. There are good ways to live. God has ideals for our benefit. But there's not this quid pro quo where God looks at you and says, all right, you did all the things right, and now you're going to get good things. It's just not how it works. And as a result, it's left thousands of people, that movement, the purity culture, has left thousands of people broken, shamed, hurting. And most grievous to me, it's damaged their relationships with other people and with their God. In fact, in one of the saddest stories, Joshua Harris, the guy who wrote I Kissed Dating Goodbye, has now divorced his wife, who he waited to have sex with. He now no longer identifies as a Christian, because for him, he had elevated sexual purity so much that when he saw how much that fell short, that didn't give him the good life he wanted, he knew no other way to interact with God. His relationship, he didn't have a relationship with a true, living, breathing, complex God. He had a relationship with a single rule of morality. And so when he lost his marriage, he lost his faith. I have a lot of pity and compassion for those people, but it's an example of what happens when we try to take the messiness of relationships and reduce them to a black and white, simple rule. We have to have context. We have to understand the purpose behind our state of being so that we can then, with nuance, adapt to what life might throw at us. So for example, last week, the simple black and white truth was single or married, pick one. But the context was, in solitude, you get your value and your worth from your Creator, and you figure that out first, and then you can be single or married, and it's not going to matter because you got that thing right. Today, as we talk about what it looks like to pursue other relationships, and yes, romantically, but this includes friendship, this includes professionally, this is any time that you seek connection with another human being, there is a deeper context, a purpose. There is a prize that we are aiming for, that if we know what that is, then we can navigate the nuance. But it's not as simple, it's not as black and white, as clean, as just giving you one quick rule for the right Christian way to pursue other people, the right way to date. But it starts with a question, and it's a question that our very own Steve Hauer asked this week in a Bible study with me. He said this, as we were talking about the right kinds of pursuit. He said, do you pursue other people primarily in order to give something or to get something? And this is the question that kind of sets us off on one of two paths for all the relationships we might seek out. Are you seeking primarily in order to give something or to get something? And down the road, long term, a healthy relationship has a little bit of both. But what is your primary orientation? What's your posture? Are you seeking out other people because you want to give something to them or to get something from them? And so let's examine these different paths, these different options, all right? If you have a getting mindset, that you want to get things from other people, here's what that tends to mean for the way that you date, the way that you pursue friendships, even professional relationships. This is what tends to happen. First of all, is that you are pursuing out of a place of lack. There is a hole in you. There's an emptiness. There's something missing. And if you pursue this other person, you will get something that will fill that hole. And if you missed last week, that's what we spent the whole time on last week, is just this one concept. So if you missed it, go back and check it out. But for now, just to say that if you're pursuing someone because you want to fill something in you, that's a getting mindset. You're trying to get something from them. Which then leads to this thing that if you're seeking worth and validation from this other person, then one of the things that goes along with that is now you idealize that other person. And we have all done that, right? When there's a cool person at school or someone that everyone looks up to and is charismatic, like you want to be friends with them, and you just think, oh man, they're so great. I just would love to have them in my circle. Or when you are dating someone, you think, oh man, they're so handsome. They're so beautiful. Oh man, I'd love to have them in my life. We idealize. No one ever in the early states of pursuing a friendship, a romantic partner, no one ever starts out by saying, you know, they're not that great, but I'll date them anyway. I mean, and if you do, then there's probably some deeper problems. We might need to talk more about this one. Right? We idealize people. It's just natural. It's what makes you want to pursue them in the first place. It's because you focus on all the best things about them and you kind of ignore all the worst things about them. But then that comes with its own trap. Another pitfall of this mindset is then you tend to lose yourselves with them. And who hasn't done that, right? Where you hear that they like something or there's a standard that they have and so you just want to live up to that, right? Or you're dating someone and they say, oh man, I love Chinese food so much. And you're like, I hate Chinese food. But what do you say? You actually say, oh no, I love it too. Let's go, right? Because you just want them to like you. And so anything that you think you're afraid they might not like about you, you just bury it. Or even more harmful is when there's something about you that matters and they don't like it. And so you just get rid of it. You know, there's a passion or a hobby that you have and they think it's boring and uninteresting. And so you start to say, oh, you know what? I don't like it that much either. Because you want to be with them so much. You idealize them so much that you stop doing the thing. Or maybe it's even a relationship. You know, there's a friend that you have and then your romantic partner doesn't like your friend. And so you say, oh, you know, I'll see them some other time. I don't need to see them. And you can separate yourself from your friends, your support system, as you lose yourself to the other person. And then if this continues on long enough, if you pursue people in this kind of mindset that you're trying to get something from them, then ultimately it turns into this rut way of living where you just have these passive expectations of the person that you're with. And this is especially a problem for people that are in committed relationships. If you're already married to someone, see, those of you that think marriage means you don't have to listen to this week, you absolutely do. Because even when you have a partner, even when you have a spouse, you have to keep pursuing them. You have to keep putting effort into it. But what happens all too often is we think that once we've acquired someone, we don't have to keep pursuing them. And then we live with these passive expectations. You expect your spouse to show up in a certain way and help with the kids. And when they don't, you feel betrayed. You feel like they've let you down. You expect a partner to read your mind, to say the right thing, to get you out of the funk that you're in. And we live in this very passive, inertia, you know, inert lifestyle that just says, please, you fix me. You do the things I expect of you, and we don't actually communicate. And all of those culminate in a relationship that ultimately is saying that you are pursuing someone else for the sake of fulfilling your own needs. You stop thinking about what they actually need, and what drives your interactions is, what do I need from this relationship? Now again, as I look at this list, I've done every single one of these in various relationships. I've done it in friendships, I've done it with romantic partners, I even still do it sometimes with my own spouse. And again, just ask my wife whether I prioritize my needs more than hers or her need more than mine, and it will depend on the week which answer she will give you. See, we have to keep this in mind all the time, because this is always a trap for us. This is always a pitfall waiting for us as we are constantly pursuing the other relationships, the other people around us. And these things will lead to a small, broken, an ultimately unfulfilling relationship for you and for the other person. This ends up not blessing anybody. And yet, I would say this is the thing that drives and defines most human relationships, that it's just obvious. The reason you seek out other people is because they have something you need. They have something you want. So how do we change it? How do we shift out of this kind of a getting mindset, of pursuing people primarily for what we think we can get from them? And for me, it starts with a pretty obscure teaching of Jesus Christ. Now, if you didn't know this, Jesus taught his favorite way of teaching truth, because as we said, truth is only truth in context. Jesus loved to teach with these things called parables. And these were stories that he made up and that he would use to reveal truths about the kingdom of heaven, this new, different way of living compared to what the world expects of people. And I love it because the nature of making a story about the truth is it gives it context. Jesus himself never gave truth out of context. He never settled for a simplistic, black and white, one-size-fits-all answer. All of the truth he gave was rooted in the context of human beings and what we're trying to navigate. And so parables were perfect for this. And so in a parable, Jesus would say, all right, you have this way of living in the world, but the kingdom of heaven is like, and then he'd give a simile. He'd give a metaphorical story where each thing in the story mapped to something real. All right, so we tell a story like you know, the kingdom of heaven is like a shepherd going out and leaving the 99 to find the one sheep, just like that song we sang earlier. And then what you do, the way you interpret the truth is you connect the dots. You say, all right, so that shepherd is like God, and then the lost sheep, that's like me. And so it's saying that even when I'm lost, God will find me. And then that's how you understand the truth of the parable. Now, what happened most of the time is Jesus would tell a parable, and he'd say, the kingdom of heaven is like this, and he'd give the story, and nobody would get it. And they'd say, all right, that doesn't make sense. We don't understand. And then Jesus would get annoyed, and sometimes he would actually explain to his disciples. He'd say, all right, guys, since you don't get it, the farmer in the story represents God, and the seeds represent the good news, and he'd spell it out for them. And then they'd say, oh, okay, we get it. But most of the time, Jesus did not do that. Most of the time, he told a parable, and everyone was confused, and Jesus just said, well, think about it. Let me know what you figure out. And so we're going to look at two of Jesus' parables. These are the two shortest parables Jesus ever gave. And I gave you all this background because I want you to think of them the way we're supposed to. I want you to interpret them and try to understand them along with me. So these are two parables that Jesus himself taught. He said this. Here's the formula. The kingdom of heaven is like... That's how you introduce it. It's like treasure hidden in a field. And when a man found the treasure, he hid it again. And then in his joy, he went and he sold all he had and he bought that field. All right, parable number two. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. And when he found one of great value, he went away and he sold everything he had and he bought that pearl. There you go. There are the two parables. Nice and short. And short should mean easy to figure out, right? We'll see. All right, so to understand it, to interpret it, we have to do the thing you do with parables. All right? So you have to ask yourself, all right, this pearl, this treasure, what does that equal? What does that represent in the story? And then the man, the merchant, the one who buys the pearl or the treasure, what does that represent? Who does that represent? Now, the traditional understanding of these two parables, the bulk of scholarship today, what all the scholars tend to agree is, and hopefully I've given you a second. Have you thought about it? You have your answer. What you think it is? Okay. Scholars and theologians say that the pearl, the treasure, is the kingdom of heaven. Right? He says it's a kingdom of heaven parable. The pearl, the treasure, is the kingdom of heaven. And the man or the merchant, that's us. And so as we are going through life, when we discover this great treasure that is the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, heaven that is waiting for us, then it behooves us to get rid of everything else in this life because it pales in comparison to the value of the treasure, the pearl of heaven. Now, Jesus did not explain this parable to the disciples. He did not go on the record as saying what the pearl represented, what the merchant represented. So I can't say definitively that interpretation that all the scholars and all the theologians are wrong, because we don't know. Jesus didn't explain it. We don't know that that's wrong. I can't stand here and say that interpretation is wrong. But they're wrong. That interpretation is wrong. It's not right. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I'm going to give you a few of them. The first one is, if you interpret it that way, that goes against everything else that Jesus said in the Gospels. It goes against the entire thrust of the Bible. Because if that's your interpretation, that the pearl and the treasure are heaven, and that we are the ones who need to sell everything we have to get it, that means you can buy heaven. That means you can earn heaven. And everything else that Jesus and the Bible teach us says that no, you can't. Heaven is not something you buy. It's not something that you earn. That's called works righteousness when you think that way. And that in fact, heaven is a free gift given to us by God. And so when the scholars and the theologians, when they interpret it in this very obvious way, they have to bend over backwards to say, but don't read too much into it and don't think that that really applies to heaven this way. And I'm saying maybe that's because you've interpreted it wrong. In fact, you have to give all these caveats, all these provisos. You're doing it wrong. Here's what I think these things represent. See, I think in this story, the man, the merchant, that's God. That's God in the story. And that's consistent. When Jesus tells parables, God is usually in them. The good shepherd is God. The farmer is God. The merchant is God. Which means that this pearl, this treasure, represents something that God himself, the king of the universe, the one who has all wealth and perfection, there is something that he thought was worth giving everything he had to purchase. See, if the man or the merchant is God, then you know what that makes the pearl, the treasure? Makes it us. We're the pearl. We're the treasure. We're the thing that God, who had everything, thought it was worth giving up everything, including the life of his son, to purchase and redeem us. And that's consistent with the rest of what Scripture and Jesus teaches. See, now this parable is teaching me, it's teaching you, that we are the pearl of great price. And there is nothing of more value in the universe than you. Because God himself sold everything he had, gave everything away, an immortal life he sacrificed on the cross for your life. That's how we have to interpret this parable. That's the lesson God wants us to learn. And here's why it's so important and why I'm bringing it up today. Because what that also then means is not only that we have great value, we are the treasure that God himself wanted, it means that we have a pursuing God. We have a God who pursues us. He doesn't sit back and wait for us to find him, wait for us to get our act together, wait for us to be holy and righteous. He goes out looking for us, and he finds us in a field covered in dirt, but he recognizes our value, and he pays it all for us. And if God has pursued us because we have great value, then that changes everything about the way we pursue other relationships in this world. We no longer pursue like other people do. We don't date the way other people do. We don't have friendships or networking connections. We don't do any of that the way everyone else does, because we are starting from a completely different place. The place we are starting from is that you are the thing of most value in the universe because God loves you and he paid everything he had for you. And one of the first apostles, this guy Paul, who we've been seeking for his wisdom on relationships, he knew that truth deeply. He knew these parables, and he understood them rightly. And so as he wades into this conversation about how Christians should date, how Christians should pursue friendships and other relationships, that is his starting point. We look at 1 Corinthians 9. Look at how Paul starts this conversation. He says, even though I am a free man with no master. And if you don't know the politics of Rome, that is not true according to earthly terms. Paul absolutely had a master. His name was the emperor. And he got to do whatever he wanted to do. All right, there were kings, there were presidents, there were hierarchies in the religious side of things. You absolutely had a master. And Paul is saying, because I am the pearl of great price, because I am the hidden treasure, I have no master. Nobody is worth more than me. Nobody has more value than me, because I have been paid for by God, and my value has been dictated by the price God was willing to pay for me. That's the solitude message. But then he chooses to do something different with that. With that truth, Paul then chooses, oh no, we're still there. He chooses to become a slave to all people, to bring any to Christ. He chooses to pursue others, not from a place of lack or cravenness, but from a place of strength and value, he pursues others. So now let's look at this list again and see how this changes everything. See, now we don't pursue out of our lack. We pursue out of our worth. We have something of value to offer the people around us. We do. Like, this now means that we don't have to be craven. We don't have to hope that someone deigns to accept us as a friend, as a romantic partner, as someone to hire or work with. We're pursuing them because we are amazing. I am a catch. Because God says I am. Because he caught me. And he paid a lot for me. And not just me. That means you're a catch too. In fact, I want you to turn to your neighbor and say to them, I'm a catch. It's awkward, but it's true. It's true. Every one of you here, no matter how flawed you might think you are, no matter how messed up the relationships you may have had are, you are by definition a catch, because God caught you and God says you're worth everything. See, and then Paul continues. He says, so now notice this, when I was with the Jews, so he's pursuing everyone, he's becoming a slave to others, and when I was with the Jews, it's one group of people, I lived like a Jew. I accommodated myself to the way Jews were, to bring the Jews to Christ. So when I was with those who follow the Jewish law, I too lived under that law. I accommodated myself. Even though I'm not a subject to the law, I don't change. My value isn't any lesser. But I did this so that I could bring to Christ those who are under the law. But on the other side, when I'm with the Gentiles who don't follow Jewish law, then I too live apart from that law so that I can bring them to Christ. But I do not ignore the law of God. I obey the law of Christ, which is to love others. And in fact, when I am with those who are weak, I share their weakness, for I want to bring the weak to Christ. I share their weakness. See, so much of what Christian culture has turned into, the way we pursue others, is it's this shame-based thing. It's saying that when you mess up, when you're broken, when you're weak, you should be shamed. And Paul says, no, 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 we see each other's weaknesses clearly, not to shame them, but to share them. To let that be a bond of connection so that we can be agents of grace in their lives. And see, this is what it changes when we become pursuers this way. See, we no longer idealize the other person. We pretend that they're perfect or they're better. We accurately realize the other person. We see their weaknesses. We see their strengths. We know that they have value just like we do because we are all pearls of great price. And now we can engage in an accurate, clear-sighted relationship with them. We don't have to pretend they're better. We don't have to pretend we're worse. We see them for who we are. We're transparent about who we are. And we have relationships based on honesty and transparency, a realization of ourselves and others. And Paul isn't done. He keeps going. He says, yes, I try to find common ground with everyone around me, doing everything I can to save some. And notice the contrast here. Everyone, knowing that, not everyone's going to respond. See, the thing about pursuit is it doesn't put an obligation on the person you're pursuing. You can pursue everyone like Paul did, knowing that some aren't going to be interested, and that's okay, because when you are a pearl of great price, when you have value, their actions don't dictate your worth. And by the way, this is a moment to just call out again, this is not just a message about dating. Paul was a single person committed to staying single for the rest of his life, and yet that singleness drove him to be a man of pursuit, that he pursued everyone, knowing that not everyone would say yes. This message also applies for people that are already in committed relationships, that are already married. You still have someone that you need to pursue with everything that you have, because just because you've said I do or you've kind of had a commitment doesn't mean that your pursuit of them stops. See, this is how this changes the way we pursue others. See, now, instead of losing ourselves, we expand ourselves. See, Paul, if he just stayed single, again, this mindset of being single, and he said, all right, well, whatever, I'm a Jewish guy living in Rome, living this certain life, don't have kids or wife, and this is just who I am. It's a very narrow and limited way to live. But by pursuing everyone, he got to meet Jews and Greeks. He got to meet kings and slaves. He got to see people all across the spectrum, and every one of them expanded his horizons. See, when you have value, you don't have to lose yourself in the experiences of others. You can just simply add them to what's already good. For example, when I married my wife, one of the things that was important and valuable to her was she had really benefited from counseling. and going to see a counselor at various portions of her life. And when we got married initially, I was like, well, that's great for you. I'm glad that that's helpful for you. But for me, myself, I don't really see the need or the benefit for me, this idea of going and sitting in a room talking to someone for an hour about your feelings. I mean, I don't have feelings, so it's kind of a waste of time. But I expanded my horizons. It was important to her, and so I started to seek it out, and partly because it clearly helped our relationship, and so we do marriage counseling, and then I started to get individual counseling. And what's happened is that's now become a thing that's enriched and made my life fuller. It turns out I do have feelings. They were just shoved like way down in here somewhere, and I never knew it. Counseling exposed that. I didn't pretend to be something I'm not. I didn't lose who I was. I willingly and out of joy and abundance let her add something to my life. And then Paul says the next turn, which is a little interesting. He says, here's the other thing that marks the difference between the way a Christian pursues others and the way the world does. He says, I do everything I can to spread the good news and to share in its blessings. Don't you realize that in a race, everyone runs, but only one person gets the prize? So run to win. He's saying, guys, this is hard. This takes effort. Running a race is not something that you casually fall into doing. You have to train your body. You have to practice. You have to get strong. You have to put constant effort in to win a race. So how does that apply to us as pursuers? Well, we can't just have passive expectations. We have to make active effort. If there is a relationship that you want to be investing in, to be pursuing, this is what it takes. And if any of you are in the doghouse right now after Valentine's Day 2 days ago, this is probably why. You forgot to make active effort. And it cost you. There was a consequence. See, we can't ever think, and I confess, I fall into this so much, that I assume that once you've gotten everything right, now you're just going to be in the rut. You're going to be in the zone. And now relationship will get easy. Once you've done the hard work of pursuing, then it gets easy after that. It never does. Just like you can be a marathon runner and win races, it doesn't mean that you have to stop training. You have to keep trying. You have to keep putting effort in. And then Paul wraps up with this point. He says, look, all athletes are disciplined in their training. Now, they do it to win a prize that will fade away, but we do it for an eternal prize. And so now the question becomes again, what eternal prize is Paul talking about? Now, the obvious, simplest connect-the-dots answer when you start talking about eternal prizes and the way that most people will understand this part of Paul is they'll say, oh, the eternal prize is heaven. And we need to be disciplined with training. We need to do it so that we can win this eternal prize of heaven. But as we've already talked about, and hopefully you've locked in, that's not how heaven works. And in fact, the eternal prize of heaven, you and I already have, whether we never pursue another person or not, whether we work hard to run a race or not. You have been given it because God simply said, you're the pearl, you're the treasure, I want you with me forever. Paul can't be talking about heaven. So what's the eternal prize? Here's the context. This is the thing that can actually change every single one of our relationships. The eternal prize that Paul is talking about is the other person. It's saying to someone, I want to be in a relationship with you because I just want to be in heaven forever with you. You're the prize. You're the thing I want. I already have everything I need from God. I have value. I have worth. I have heaven for eternity waiting for me. I have everything I need from God, but I want you with me as a friend, as a partner, as a spouse, as a coworker, as a networker, whatever it is, whoever that person is, whatever relationship you are pursuing with them, what you're saying to them is, you are now the prize I pursue. I've gotten everything else I need. I just want you with me. And then what that changes then is now we no longer prioritize our needs because our needs have been met by the one being who can meet them, God. We can now prioritize their needs. This is what a model of giving pursuit looks like. But I also need to make a caution here. I want to caution you not to take any one of these bullet points out of context. Because when you take things out of context, even if they were originally true, they become toxic and they lead to death. This last bullet point about pursuing others and prioritizing the other person's needs, this is only life-giving and blessing if you've gotten the first bullet point right and if you've done everything else in between. See, because if you don't have this right, if you don't think that you have worth, if you pursue another person out of your own perceived lack of value, and then you try to prioritize their needs, that's called abuse. It's called enabling and codependency and enmeshment. It becomes an excuse to enable the other person's worst behaviors as they denigrate and devalue you. This, by its own, becomes just as toxic as purity culture ever did. This only becomes life-giving and true when you live all of this in context, when you have a relationship with God that gives you your value and your worth, when you see the other person accurately and know what they need and what would enable them, when you're actually able to expand yourself, not bury yourself, and when you know that your active effort is for the sake of blessing you and them, then and only then does prioritizing their needs become a healthy, life-giving thing to do. See, because the other thing about this is nothing about this hinges on their response to your pursuit. So here's the other piece of this truth. You can pursue someone else for all of these reasons, and they might say no. They might reject you. You might have spent 10 years of marriage pursuing them and faced the fact that you are not in this kind of a pursuit anymore. But the promise is not that when you live this way, that God automatically blesses your relationships, makes everything you do work out. The promise is that if you do it this way, you will be a source of life to the people around you. You will change yourself and others. And maybe individual relationships will or will not work out, but what will not change is that you will be a shining pearl, giving yourself out of abundance for the sake of blessing people around you. This is the truth of how we are called to pursue relationships. This is why a Christian's initiation seeking out of others looks different from the world's. Not by some sort of simple morality rule, but the fact that we who have great value recognize the value in others and want to serve and love and invite them into eternity with us. May that mark and change all of your relationships. Amen. Now, just like last week, I want to give you some time to be thoughtful, to be introspective, and I encourage you to think, well, first of all, we're going to sing a song, and I give you permission not to sing. It's a song you probably don't know. And if the song helps guide your thoughts, then listen and reflect on the words, and just let those words be the truth that you need to hear. But secondarily, I invite you to evaluate the relationships in your life, the people that you've thought about pursuing and haven't, and what it might look like to pursue them in a different way. The people that you've already pursued, you're already in relationship with them, but you recognize that you've been going about it in a way that doesn't bring life and growth to both of you. And maybe there's something that you need to do differently. Or maybe even that there are relationships that you've been pursuing, that you've been in, that you need to let them go and let them be whoever God needs them to be on their own, because your worth is not tied up in how that other person responds to you. So whatever that might be, spend some time inviting God in and asking him to shine light on what you can or should be doing differently in pursuit of the relationships around you.